Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable Chief Justice David Gilbertson presiding, is now in session.
Please be seated. The record may show that this is the time and the place set in the matter of a special rules hearing ordered by this court. Due and public notice has been given to the public and the bar of the time and place of this hearing, along with the proposals that the court was going to consider. At this time, we would take any public comment of any individual who wishes to speak. I guess, Professor Hutton, you're the public. We did get your submissions, but anything, you came all the way from Vermilion, you might as well give us your best shot. Sure, yeah, please use the podium because we're on the internet.
Good morning to all of you, and it's very nice to be here. I appreciate the opportunity to speak about the proposed rules. By way of background, as chair of the Evidence Committee since 2011, we worked very hard on making recommendation to the court about adopting the stylistic changes that had been implemented for the federal rules of evidence. And I'm very pleased to see that the court has accepted the recommendations from the committee and that those changes will be made. We were very careful to deal with stylistic changes only because that's what our charge was, that's what we thought we should do, and we did not make substantive change recommendations except in a very few instances. So the rules that you have put for hearing would have involved substantive recommendations from the committee, and we did not deal with those at all. And I partly say that because at this point I'm not sure what the Evidence Committee's recommendations would be on these rules. The notice for hearing came up toward the end of the service of this Evidence Committee, and with a new bar president, I'm not exactly sure what the committee appointments are. So my written submission, it basically is just my comments, and it does not represent those of any kind of a committee recommendation. I had objections to three rules that you have proposed, comments on a fourth rule. The remainder of the rules brought no objection, comment, or anything from me or anyone else I know. So would you like me to go through each of the rules, or what would you like me to do?
Maybe the three you have a problem with.
Okay.
If the rest of them, the court could certainly ask questions from the bench or if you wanted to, but I'm just guessing those are the three that are we want to hear about.
Okay, that sounds good to me. I also will note that I put a chart together for each one of the rules that I wanted to comment on. And the chart contains the rules from various states that deal with these issues. And I didn't do that because I thought you would just follow what everybody else does, but I thought you might find it interesting to see what other states have done with the federal rules that you've proposed. So that's actually by way of information only. Sarah Kammer, one of our librarians, is the person who helped me. Well, she's the one that put the she did the hyperlinks, and then we went through all the charts together to make sure that we gave you an accurate representation of what the state rules are. She used the Weinstein's evidence charts. We then commented on them. And right from the outset, I will acknowledge that I did not do thorough research on every state's rules. I did not look up all the case law that interprets those rules from each state. No way did I do that. But I wanted to at least let you know what the rules are. So the first one I object to is 404A and the substantive change that the court has recommended. 404A deals with character evidence, and the rule as we now have it allows, basically says character is not going to be put in issue by the government in prosecuting an accused in a criminal case. However, if the defendant in the case wants to put his or her character in issue, the person can do so. The defendant, and it has to obviously be a pertinent character trait that the individual wants to raise. If the individual does so by opinion and reputation evidence, then the prosecution can respond. So that one is very clear cut. We also have the opportunity for the defendant to put character of the victim in issue in a particular, in an appropriate case. And if the defendant does so, then the defendant uses opinion and reputation evidence in that sense as well, and the prosecution can rebut. The proposed change that you have recommended allows the prosecution to rebut in an additional way from the way that the rule is now written and from the way that the rule was originally written. And the proposed change that you have recommended embodies a change that was made to the federal rules in the year 2000, and the rules were rearranged after that. But that's about how long this rule has been in place in the federal system. And at the risk of using the number 404A2B2, is just the little phrase that I'm talking about. The rest of the rule I'm not talking about, so just that particular phrase. And that provides that if the defendant puts the character of the victim in issue, then the typical rebuttal, which is that the prosecution can undercut that evidence, is now augmented by allowing the prosecution to respond with character evidence involving the defendant's same trait. And that is a change that we've had for about 15 years. It seems not to have been widely accepted by state courts. It seems not to have been used very much. As I understand it, there may be some politics behind some of this. The Department of Justice made that recommendation. Congress put it into a statute, and eventually the court included it in a rule.
So this is actually an act of Congress. It's not through the normal federal procedures.
I think it started as an act of Congress, and then eventually it went through the normal procedure, but it started out in Congress, as far as I understand. The rationale behind the rule is to give us a full picture of the defendant's character. If the defendant raises something about the victim, then we wouldn't have a full picture unless we also allow this rebuttal that is embodied in this subsection of the rule. And I respectfully disagree that we don't have other opportunities to get a full picture of the defendant. And as I mentioned in my paper, the way that we typically get a very full picture of the defendant is with Rule 404B. Rule 404B is not character evidence, I understand that, but it allows introduction of pertinent actions of the defendant to show, well, you know the long list, motive, opportunity, intent, plan, preparation, knowledge, identity, absence of mistake or accident, and everything else that we can think of other than character itself. When you are thinking about somebody's character, very often you're thinking about the specific acts that compose that character. So if you want to say somebody has a violent character, well, what would make you think that? Well, it would be the specific actions the person has engaged in that add up to a violent type of person. And so I think 404B is a very effective way of giving us a full picture of the defendant. I think jurors would prefer to hear of specific actions that they would then be able to evaluate in a case rather than just hear, in my opinion, the defendant is a violent person, or by reputation, the defendant is a violent person. So I don't see that this subsection of the rule adds very much.
The examples in here, the easy example is if it's a fight between people on violent character of one possibly goes to the, and then you add the violent character of the other. But what happens to relevance with this and the character trait of a victim wouldn't necessarily be a relevant character, wouldn't be relevant to the actions or to the trait that they're trying to get in of the defendant.
I see what you're getting at, but let's take an example of an aggravated assault case, and the defendant wants to say that the victim is a violent person. The prosecution obviously can rebut and say the victim is not a violent person. This rule allows us to also say the defendant is a violent person.
Right.
And so, you know, violence is what we're thinking about.
What about something else where it's maybe not as clear that it's the same?
I know, and that's where it gets to be a little bit tough, because it's hard to figure out what character trait you're going to pick out of the victim and what character trait of the defendant would be so different that you wouldn't already have gotten that in with 404B evidence. I think that's the problem in use of this rule. It just doesn't have that much utility, because in a real case, what you're talking about in terms of character traits, I mean, and violence is the one that I think pretty typically is what comes to mind. it's going to be dealt, you're going to have comparable character traits that you're worrying about. You're not going to, you know, for example, in a fraud case, the defendant is not going to bring up that the victim has a violent character. That just doesn't make any sense at all. And so I think the character traits mesh pretty well in actuality. So I don't think that's really a problem with trying to get this evidence in about the defendant.
Well, that's presuming, though, that a trial court would let it in under 404B, and I agree that the setting in which this most often occurs is a self-defense claim where evidence of violent conduct of the victim when consuming alcohol, for example, comes into evidence. And so if the defense then elicits that character trait of the victim, if the trial court doesn't let in the defendant's similar trait under 404B, that would be an example of when this rule would be applicable.
I think not. This rule is not supposed to deal with issues. If you're thinking about the assault case or that sort of stuff, and we want to think about the defendant's actions here and whether he acted in self-defense, that's all state of mind. That's not character evidence. And so these rules don't even apply in that setting. We're talking about what does the defendant understand about this person that would give the defendant an honest and reasonable apprehension that death or grievous bodily harm was imminently threatened.
So it would be evidence of prior acts by the victim, for example, when intoxicated.
Right.
A character trait of violence when intoxicated.
That's not really what we're getting at. What we're talking about, if you have specific conduct by the victim in the case, that's not character evidence. That's conduct evidence that's relevant to the defendant's state of mind. Character evidence is, you know, this is a particular violent type of thing. That's not really what we're getting at when we're trying to prove the defendant's state of mind.
So we're talking about the pertinent traits.
Mm-hmm.
So if the ability to offer evidence of the defendant's same trait under subdivision 2.
Right. And so if you are, you know, if you're thinking about subdivision 2 and character evidence, the defendant isn't even in that section if the defendant is bringing up prior acts of the victim's conduct to show the defendant's fear of the victim. That's not character evidence. That's prior conduct evidence by the victim. And if you want, so transforming that into character evidence is actually not even necessary and probably not that effective if for some reason the defendant wants to transform that into character evidence. But, I mean, it's not... Let's say the defendant wants to transform that into character evidence instead of using the specific conduct of the victim to show the defendant's state of mind. If they want to transform that into character evidence, they could. And then we have the proper rebuttal, this victim is not violent, this victim is, with the prosecution rebutting the defendant's assertion. And then whatever else we have in the case in terms of the defendant's actions at the time, 404B evidence, all that is still going to be coming in. The only thing that this rule deals with is if the defendant does transform the specific acts into character evidence, that we would then rebut with the defendant's character.
Okay.
Is there something?
Have a question mark on your face. I can see that.
I'm looking at the way that this was applied in Latham, and then the following case, Connect.
Mm-hmm.
And State versus Connect. And you mentioned Latham in your written materials.
Right.
And so I think you've answered my question.
Okay. I think Justice Enter's got one.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Justice Enter, but I
got it.
Justice Kern had that question.
So the rest of the rule as reformulated mm-hmm. would be okay.
Yes.
You're saying take the new rule, the new formulation, but just strike subdivision 2.
2B2.
Right.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes. And the rest of the rule then would be comparable to the rule that we now have.
Right. Okay. So the other thing is, if it doesn't come in, if the defense, obviously, it's more difficult to get in character under 404B, the defendant's character. This just seems to allow, make a specific, almost an exception to 404B. Is that right?
everyone who deals with 404B starts out by saying it's not character evidence. I have to say that as well. And 404A is character evidence. But what you have suggested is a very broad barn door opening when you're talking about prior acts evidence. The problem, though, is, to me, 404B is effective because you bring up prior specific conduct, specific actions. All you're getting in under 404A, under this character evidence, is opinion evidence and reputation evidence. That is limited to asking the witness, right, do you have an opinion about this person's character for violence? Yes, I do. What is that opinion? In my opinion, he's a violent person. I mean, that doesn't really get you far, and you can't start asking all the follow-up questions like, what makes you think so? That's not admissible under 404A. It's only on cross-examination that those specific actions would come up, and it would be the other side trying to, you know, undercut that person's opinion or the comparable reputation evidence.
Okay, let's go to number two. Okay. You don't like.
I don't. I think 404B is enough, and the court interprets 404B so that I'm comfortable in saying it's enough. If I didn't think it didn't do the job, I guess I would say that as well. Okay, 609. When I started to teach evidence at USD School of Law, from the beginning, I knew that there were certain provisions in our state code that were comparable to the federal and that there were a few that were not. And 609 is one that strikes everybody right away as not being comparable to the federal rule. I was surprised when I started to do research on what other states have done with 609A to find that so many of them do not have the comparable federal version in their codes. I tried to figure out where we got ours. Uniform Rules of Evidence had something similar, but I think honestly that the states and commentators just recommended deviating from 609, partly because 609, as I understand it, was the product of compromise when it was being developed initially. So 609 is divided into two parts, but 609A, the only section of the rule that we're talking about. The first part, and when we're thinking about 609, we're thinking about impeachment of witnesses. So we're dealing with believability of witnesses who are testifying at trial. That's the limited scope for 609. And if a person who is testifying at trial, whether that's the accused in a criminal case or any other witness, whether in a civil case or criminal case, anyone else, then we'd look to see whether that person has prior convictions. And then we make a determination whether they should be admitted to show that this person's credibility is an issue, believability is an issue, because of the prior conviction. And I say that at the outset just because some people from the get-go think that this doesn't make any sense. So that if you're talking about impeaching somebody's believability with a prior conviction for aggravated assault, there's a disconnect between truth-telling and assault. But the drafters of our state rule and the drafters of the federal rule overcame that potential issue and said, yes, we should look at people's prior convictions when we're judging their believability as a witness. So 609 is in place in the state code and in the federal. When you are dealing with witnesses in our state code, we look at the prior conviction to see whether the probative value outweighs the prejudice. And we decide case-by-case basis with the accused and any witness, whether it's a prosecution witness, defense witness, or a witness in a civil case. We look at those witnesses' prior convictions and make the judgment call whether the probative value of the prior outweighs the prejudicial effect. The federal rule does not work that way. The federal rule says if you're the defendant in a criminal case, yes, we'll look at probative value and measure that against prejudicial effect. And if the probative value exceeds the prejudicial effect, then the conviction comes in. But for witnesses, and again, whether you're talking civil case, prosecution witnesses in a criminal case, defense witnesses in a criminal case, their prior convictions come in unless under 403 unfair prejudice substantially outweighs the probative value. So basically the provision in the federal rule says prior convictions come in. Our state provision says they may come in, but only if they're important enough that we can make the judgment that the probative value exceeds the prejudice. And so I think that's a substantial difference. You know, this is a rule that doesn't necessarily benefit one side or the other. It's basically a way to deal with witnesses in all kinds of cases. So you can't say it's a pro-prosecution rule or a pro-defense rule. It doesn't really work that way. It basically just looks at who the witness, what the witness's prior convictions are, and makes a judgment call in each case whether or not they should come in. So that's part one of the rule, and I prefer what is in our state code, and many other states actually prefer what we have in our state rule as well. The second part of the federal rule says that if the individual, the witness, has a prior conviction, whether felony or misdemeanor, that involves dishonesty or false statement, that has to come in. Has to come in. Our rule does not mandate that the prior come in if it involves dishonesty or false statement. Our rule gives the judge the discretion to judge whether or not it should come in. And so it might be that you would have a judge who says, you know, under the circumstances of the prior, it doesn't make sense for us to let this in, and the judge would have the discretion to keep it out. And again, I personally like the idea of giving the judge the discretion of dealing with an issue in a particular case. My assumption is that most of the time these convictions will come in, but if a judge thinks that it would be inappropriate or unjust or whatever it is, then the judge has the discretion in that particular case to keep the conviction out. So I think we're in good company with other states who have a rule that is comparable to what we have under our 609A. And I think it treats witnesses more fairly, possibly, but I think it also maintains some judicial discretion, which I think is appropriate under these circumstances.
Okay.
What about, I can't remember what you recommended the first time. I mean, I see there's some gender stuff in the old rule.
Yeah, and what we recommended with when the evidence committee went through was just to keep the rule the way we have it, which is what my recommendation is today. And we made that recommendation at the time because for us to do anything else would have been a substantive change. We couldn't do just a stylistic change to that particular rule.
Okay. The third one you don't care for.
The third one is 704B. There are a few people in this room who have been my students in the evidence class. And they heard me say this, so I will acknowledge it right now. I never liked 704B, and I think that probably is pretty evident from the materials I submitted. 704B, I think, was a political response to Congress's dismay over the verdict in the John Hinckley Jr. situation where he was found not guilty by reason of insanity. There are many other aspects to that case that we don't need to go into today, but tackling the evidence rule that Congress came up with 704B, to me, was not really the answer to how you would deal with what occurred in that case. At any rate, 704B is in place in the federal system. Again, I did not know how many states had adopted 704B, considered it, rejected it, and we don't have that many who have embraced 704B. And so, again, not that you're going to follow what other states do, but I think it's just interesting to know that they have not felt it necessary to adopt 704B other than the few that I note there. 704B prevents the expert from giving an opinion about the defendant's mental state in a criminal case. And I know that when the rule was, conceptually, the rule was designed to keep the psychiatrist from giving that last sentence saying, the defendant is not responsible for what he did because his mental disease or defect makes him not responsible. The rule was designed to keep that sentence out. The problem is the rule is written so broadly, and as I mentioned in my materials, once you're talking about the defendant's intent in a criminal case, it's not just in the psychiatric context, but its intent across the board, including when you're talking about drug crimes and other situations. And so the rule is written much more broadly than it would than you would think if it is just to deal with psychiatric issues. I think for most courts, when they look at the rule, most state courts that have rejected it have basically said, we don't need it. We already have Rule 702 that deals with expert testimony, opinion expert testimony. We already have, and in this stay. We also have Rule 704 that says, you know, an expert's opinion is not inadmissible just because it happens to reach ultimate issue testimony. We also have Rule 403 that enables us to keep out, whether it's expert testimony or any other testimony, if the danger of unfair prejudice is such that we think the testimony needs to be excluded. So if you think there might be a problem with having the expert testify in certain ways, we've got rules already that address that. My personal opinion, and this is definitely my personal opinion, is if I'm sitting on a jury, I would just as soon hear everything the expert has to say. And I don't want people to start carving out little parts of it that the expert can't talk about just because I know at the end of the day I'm going to sit there and evaluate what the person says. I know that the theory behind that is that jurors might have difficulty doing that and might be too overwhelmed if an expert answers, you know, the specifics about what the opinion is. But I personally don't think that that's an issue that needs to be dealt with by rule. If the expert is treading on ground that's pretty thin, then I think we can deal with it with the rules that we already have. And I actually personally welcome experts or any other witnesses give us a full picture of what they actually think about a case, and not having their testimony cabined so much that we don't actually understand what the person thinks. 704B tries to put some clamps on this. It may be effective in some cases. It doesn't keep out what the psychiatric testimony is. It doesn't keep out what the characteristics of the individual are. It lets all that stuff in. It's basically just supposedly keeping out that last sentence where the psychiatrist says whether or not the individual is responsible. I think we already have rules in place, as I mentioned, 702, 704, and 403, plus I think our case law is on track with that. If we think an expert's opinion is helpful, it can come in, but the expert is not supposed to, you know, give us testimony that's not helpful to the jury. Even if the expert's testimony deals with ultimate issues, 704A says that that can come in. As long as we have reliable and relevant expert testimony, our rules allow it to come in right now, and we don't carve out a specific type of testimony that we want to exclude from an expert.
You know, looking back and up and looking at 704A and B together, it's my, I'm wondering out loud what your observation would be. But to me, it seems like our cases have not allowed ultimate issue testimony in spite of 704A.
I think our cases say that the expert can't say that an element is satisfied. And I think sometimes that can look like we're getting at ultimate issue testimony. But I think if you analyze it, you know, it may not be quite that much. But if it is that the expert is saying this element is met, that's where you run into a problem, and that's where the trial court could eliminate that particular testimony. But I think apart from that, and the Guthrie case is a good example, and I know, Chief, you were involved in that case, you know, and your opinion dealt with this issue. That is, are we getting to the ultimate issue? And you said no. Others on the court said yes. We can disagree over what the ultimate issue is. We can disagree over whether this testimony reaches it. If we think it's going to be unfairly prejudicial under 403, we could keep that sentence out.
But it doesn't. Don't our cases say no ultimate issue?
No, I think our cases say no element.
Okay.
And I think it can be a little tough to say, is this an element or is this the ultimate issue? And in a particular case, you could deal with that. I think, you know, in psychiatric testimony, when you say the defendant is not responsible for this offense because he is insane, you know, that looks like it gets much closer to ultimate issue testimony. But everything else, admissible.
I guess I asked that because I kind of thought our cases would have prohibited this kind of psychiatric testimony anyway.
If the psychiatric testimony hits an element, yes, our cases and our rules already do. That is correct. 704B was definitely a political decision. I mean, that was the result of a political decision, and I think Congress recognizes that, and everybody else does as well. So if you think the rules already satisfy the problem, then 704B is extraneous.
Do you have any other comments you wish to make on any of the proposals other than the three you've outlined your concerns on?
Those are the three I object to, and I submitted just general comments on 804B6, forfeiture by misconduct. I think 804B6 is, a majority of the states have adopted it. I actually was a little bit surprised to see that a number of states have rejected it. However, if you do adopt 804B6, forfeiture by misconduct of hearsay and confrontation clause objections, there may be some hidden issues, and I outline those in my submission. That is, I think we need to have a pretrial hearing. I think we have to establish by a preponderance that the defendant had the misconduct, engaged in the misconduct, and it was with the intent to keep this witness from testifying, which is what Giles versus California requires. I think there is a potential issue of going too broadly. So, for example, when we say they forfeit their hearsay objections, correct, but was this relevant testimony to begin with? So I think there's probably going to be an issue of relevance first, and then they would forfeit the hearsay objection. But if the testimony wouldn't have even been relevant from the get-go, I think it has to be dealt with that way and not have the hearsay issue overwhelm that. Apart from that, I think the procedural issues that I outlined in the paper are the ones that courts have had to confront, and I don't see how to write all of those into a rule, but so I'm assuming that they would come up from case law over time.
Okay. Any other questions for Professor Hutton from the bench?
Just one, and I think this is obvious unless I'm missing something. In 902, 11 and 12, there's reference in at least the notes that I have from the notice to federal statutes and Supreme Court. I assume that's just copying over federal rules without adjusting it for our state, and
correct.
I can't think of any reason we would refer to the federal courts or
correct. It's just to the change should refer to the state rules. Yes, that's
so. That's just a Scrivener's error for a better term.
Correct.
Well, I'd like to thank you, Professor Hutton, for the effort that you have made in your work with the evidence committee from the state bar and having these rules restyled, and then appearing here today and seeing this entire process through. You've made a tremendous contribution, so I thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate your saying so.
Thank you for making the long drive, too.
And it wasn't 100 when I got here, so it was okay.
Yes, you're lucky it wasn't Sunday.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And I do appreciate that you're dealing with these rules. I think this is terrific, so thanks for
right,
the opportunity.
Great. Well, you being the only member of the public in the courtroom, I guess nobody else wishes to speak unless the clerks want to give a run at it. Okay, if not, we're in recess until 10 o'clock. Thank you.